Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
As a drummer in a band, you always have that pressure on you to make sure that the rhythm must keep going, must be bang on all the time. You're the backbone. You're holding everything together. But probably for a lot of drummers, it's not unnatural to carry that through into the other things that you do. And if that's in your nature, you tend to do that in things in your life as well, I guess.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
As Dead Can Dance, we never did the kind of Spinal Tap type tours. We always did like short burst sort of tours. So they were very intense, but they were brief enough not to really bring us down, kind of thing. But also beyond the just the confines of the band, it was really fun on 4AD in those days. I mean, the first after we signed 4AD and recorded the first album, we were then pushed straight out on tour with the Cocteau Twins. So I'm found myself not only suddenly being a member of Dead Can Dance, but also being able to watch Robin and Liz perform every night after we'd finished. And I thought I was in seventh heaven. This was just amazing. They're incredible gigs when you think back on it now. That if you were in the audience for those, you saw first of all Lisa Gerrard perform, and then you saw Liz Fraser perform on the same stage. That was quite a thing.
Yes, powerful. Yes, yes. And great artwork. I mean, amazing artwork department as well.
Yes.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, Vaughan Oliver, who was running the art department at 4AD, he, you know, me and Brendan played football with him, and, it was good times. We were close with a lot of people in those days, and other bands on the label. Diff Jars, Wolfgang Press, we were good friends with everybody.
You know, though, it's like things, you know, it's a small business and things connect all the way along the line, because when I came to do my second book just out, Goth History, the cover was...
Tim O'Donnell.
Yes, right. So I worked with him on that. You know, I gave him a photograph,
yes.
And then he
came back
with this thing with this beautiful design, and I thought, yep, it's meant to be. So there's always those connections, you know, which...
Yeah, he's great. And he did the cover for my first solo album.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, no, he's a great guy and a great artist, and liked what he did a lot.
Yeah, I loved him.
I think the key there is you played football together.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Sadly, Vaughan had a really bad injury in the game we were playing in, so there was a downside to that, but it was fun while it lasted.
We used to play a lot of football together on tour with the crew, and that had a really bad downside because we'd be playing these big halls and, you know, kicking this ball around, and at the end of the night we'd have this bill... you know, for 365 marks of football on the wall to be painted over, you know, stuff like that. So
now Lisa wasn't, she wasn't down there playing football, right?
No. She would always try and turn the conversation on to Aussie rules, which I don't have a clue about.
It's those tight shorts they wear. I know what it is. Yes. They're built well, those Aussie lads, I think, yeah. I come from a rugby town myself.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, Rugby League, St. Helens Rugby League.
Oh, St. Helens, okay, right.
Yeah, rivals, Wigan. And, yeah, it's very difficult trying to find a musical outlet in a rugby league town. There are not many. Not many came out of St. Helens. I must have, you know, they must have broke the mold. But Liverpool was always a good, you know, a good destination.
So you didn't play the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club?
Oh, then? Yes. I mean, my very early days were spent conservative clubs, labour clubs, working men's clubs in northwest England. We didn't get too far, but far enough as a, I think I was about 13.
No, that's a tough gig. That's a tough gig.
Yeah, well, it was three gigs a night. It was three sets. Different speeds. And it was all pop songs in the last bit and classics in the first one and ballads in the middle somewhere. I kind of put my hours in and learned how to rehearse other people's music. And it really paid off when I got to Liverpool because people wanted to start bands, you know, punk bands. And they did, but they didn't know the first thing about how to tune up, how to rehearse, how to even, what do you do, you know? They really thought the idea was to turn up, have a laugh, get drunk,
yeah,
and then go and do the gig. Like, no, you have to know what you're doing a little bit. And I found myself very, very unpopular.
So it sounds like the early days of the Cure rehearsals. Yeah.
No, but that was the essence of punk spirit, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
just turn up and get on stage and go for it.
It was, but we were not like kind of kids punk rock. We were already pushing 20, you know. So we shouldn't.
Yeah.
Somebody should have known better. But the attitude was they'd never done it before. That was the first stab at, you know, playing music and forming a band.
Right.
Lisa and Brendan had already done the rounds in Sydney or Melbourne or?
Melbourne. Yeah, Melbourne.
In Melbourne. So that's a very cultural city.
Yes.
But then it's Australia still, so there's going to be like, you know, the bar attitude and the Australian rules.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's they were playing, you know, small clubs and hotel bars and that kind of thing in Melbourne before they came to London.
Yeah. Because we didn't get to Australia until like 82 or something like that, I think, 81 and 80, maybe later. And it was rough. It was, you know, you had to be careful where you went out, you know, made sure you knew where the exit was, you know, in the club.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Lisa had a really tough sort of baptism in that because she used to play, before she knew Brendan, she used to play solo in those kind of bars.
Oh, my God.
And when her parents found out she was doing it, they went crazy. but she looked after herself.
One can only imagine the I was going to say the what do you call it? What would you call it? The rebuke to the heckler. You'd have to be pretty quick, and
she is, and she's also she's very quick witted and very funny and very very able to deal with those kind of situations. So yeah, she's
that reminds me of somebody else I knew who was able to do that kind of stuff pretty quick.
Well, yeah. Of course you see, now we disclose our telepathy, lol, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, of course, that's what Susie was very much that, you know. It happened in the day-to-day as well. She would always, like, champion the underdog.
Yeah.
If there was somebody I always recall a time in an Indian restaurant off the Earls Court Road, and it was quite near the police station headquarters. And it was, and the guys came in, they were having a few drinks, and they were being a bit, you know, not proper. And she just stood up and shouted them all down and said, you know, just like, if you can't treat somebody with respect, then just get up and leave. And I think, like, the boss of the gang just, like, got all the guys, and they all left quietly.
Wow.
But she would be quite straightforward as well. And, like, if she had, like, pair of stilettos on, I know, because I was the one on the ground and about to get kicked and straddled and said, who's first? And that kind of found its way to the stage as well.
You know? Well, it's, yes. It's
ferocious. Yeah. But loyalty, I mean, that's the thing, I suppose, I learned. Loyalty was demanded because it was given,
right?
As well, you know, you stick through with each other through whatever comes next. Is that something that did you escape that? Or as you say, when you went out with Deccan Dance and you enjoyed that, because there's a frisson, right? There's stuff that happens only in that world.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think. That was one of the things that that Brendan and Lisa appreciated from me, was that they knew they could always trust me. I'd always be there. I used to do some of the band management for us as well. Yeah. So they knew that, you know, I would handle the money trustworthily, sort everybody out, make sure people were in the right places at the right time.
Like a tour manager.
Sound checks, rehearsals, etc. I was always there. I did tour manage a band for a bit as well. I didn't have an experience. It was a kind of that was also a bit of a baptism of fire, but we felt that we could do it between us. And we didn't. At the time, we just didn't have the money to pay a manager either. I mean, we every penny we were getting was going back into equipment and stuff. And so, so we just got on with it. But I think I think and hope that that they feel that I was always there and reliable for them in that respect, and they always had that trust in me.
Yeah, I doubt you got many accolades for it, you know, like who's your medal for the month, Peter? Good job.
No, but they appreciate they were very appreciative of it, and that was enough for me for sure.
Were you the guy, if you were on the bus, you come down in the morning and like dutifully put the half drunk bottles away, and I don't know. I'd clean up the kitchen a bit.
No, I didn't go that far. I used to allow the coach driver to do that.
Oh, good, okay. I remember bus drivers saying, I am not the magic fairy. You know, I am not the person that magically cleans everything. You guys. Traveling on the road with the band, you realize who had who at home always had somebody picking up after.
Yeah,
you know, finish the meal, and it was just left there. You know, and go like, well, how's that going to get in the bin? You know, what's going to happen with that? And we are the backbone here. This is what our role is in many ways. We are the person behind the drum kit, but we are also the sense of. What is it? What do you think it is, Peter? Is there some other job description we have that nobody talks about?
Oh, that's as a drummer in a band, you always have that pressure on you to make sure that the rhythm must keep going, must be bang on all the time. You're the backbone. You're holding everything together. But probably for a lot of drummers, it's not unnatural to carry that through into the other things that you do. And if that's in your nature, you tend to do that in things in your life as well, I guess.
That's a good point. If it's in your nature to do that, what comes first, I wonder? That's in your nature, and therefore you make a good candidate for keeping the band together as drummer, Or do you adopt that nature as a drummer? I wonder, is it something to do with that? You know, obviously there are people who join, who play drums because they are, that's what they've always wanted to do. It's just the thing they were born to do. Like you, I don't think I was, and Lol, I don't think you were. No. It was just with the role we fell into. And then enjoyed it, and then explored it, and then got as much out of it as we could. But it wasn't. I never. I do remember those making music or whatever it would be. You know, like, what kind of drums do you use, Budgie? And I go like,
round ones. I use round ones.
Round. And it wasn't. It was. Yeah, there was a little bit of like, oh no, I'm not doing that kind of geeky kit rundown. Because I loved doing that. I was a kind of a, you know, I could easily be the train spotter who would tell you what label and how long the track was and what was the B-side and who mastered it. And I had a book that contained all that information before I was in bands.
Oh, okay.
But it was more to do for me with the hardware and the physicality of it. And as you say, just the sheer potential to create a dance. You know, to create movement, to give people something to hang on to like a solidity. Or when I joined the Banshees, the manager came up to me and said, "Wow, I can hear the bass drum." Mm-hmm. And I went, "Yeah, yes, normal, right?" And he went, "No, because Kenny was very light on the drums, Kenny Morris, right. And so you know, even though it's a lot of tom work." There was never really a heavy four on the floor. I mean, if it called for it, you know, it was never as heavy as my Bonham-esque effort and disco effort at four on the floor. I just wondered what comes first in that respect. You know, good, the need and desire to hold things together.
I mean, my experience as to how I came to drums was that I'd kind of dabbled with learning to play the piano as a kid and starting with the guitar. And then I was about 10 years old, my grandparents on my mother's side went away on holiday and came back with a gift for me that they'd got from South America, which was this pair of bongo drums. You know, those sort of really earthy, cheap, basic clay pots with skin stretched over them. And as a 10-year-old in, you know, in the late 60s, this was just like an unimaginable thing from another planet or something. And that was it. I was hooked.
Yeah.
So it kind of stemmed from this little gift that they'd brought back. But also interesting what you say about the, you know, being a light or a heavy drummer. When I first joined Dead Can Dance, I was far too light on the drums because I'd come from playing in pubs where we were wanted not to be too loud. You know, we were playing in small.
Yeah, to hold back.
Yeah. And so I'd never played with the kit mic'd up before. And it was also, you know, I played quite gently, and suddenly, you know, Brendan wanted this kind of driving force at the back of the band, and I had to really, you know, rewire my brain into that mode. And one of the things that helped actually was Lisa used to play a bit of additional percussion, and when I first met them, they had this African barrel drum that they'd picked up on their travels, and we were at one of the first rehearsals I was out with them. I was playing the drums, and Brendan said that Lisa was going to come in towards the end of the song on this barrel drum, and I was thinking, yeah, right, okay. and so we got to near the end of the song, and she suddenly came in, and she attacked this thing like there was no tomorrow, and she was beating the hell out of this drum, and she was drowning me out on the kit, and so I had to suddenly, you know, sort of play with much heavier, much more bigger. And Brendan just looked round, and I could see from his face, yeah, that's what I wanted.
Yes.
and that was the way he engineered it.
They were working together on this one. How do we get him to play louder? I know what we'll do.
So Machiavellianism was there behind the scenes.
So what was your first studio experience then with Deck and Dance?
It was in Blackwing Studios in South London, which was where it was used principally by Vince Clarke after
Depeche.
Post Depeche Mode, post. So we were in there, I think, just after Yazoo had sort of finished, and he was getting ready to launch the Assembly. So the place was owned by a guy called Eric Radcliffe, who there was a Yazoo album called Upstairs at Eric's, and this guy Eric was the guy who owned the studio. So it was the studio that 4AD used all the time. So the Cocteau's had recorded Garlands and their early stuff in there. But unfortunately for us, it was a very dead studio. It was really for synth bands and electronics. So we had a terrible struggle to get the drum sounds and get the acoustic instruments that we were using, get any life out of them, and also the
some air in the room to move.
Yeah. So it was that. So we really didn't have a great experience in there. I mean, Brendan really, really struggled with it. But it was very much the 4AD studio of the time. And like I say, the Cocteau's recorded there. Most of, I think, all this Mortal Coil was recorded there. So it very much featured in... I went back there later on to do sessions for the Wolfgang Press. And it was very much part of the 4AD fabric at the time, but
there was no stairwell where you could put the drums out into the staircase or the hallway.
No, there was nothing like that at all.
Yep. They used to stick you in a booth, didn't they? That was the dead drum booth, you know.
Yeah.
So nobody could hear you.
So when we recorded the EP that we did after the first album, we went to a studio. I don't know whether you ever came across it, called Vineyard in South London. And that had this, that was a complete other end of the spectrum. It had this huge wooden live room, which we just went crazy in, and we were recording the drums and the hammered dulcimer and that in there, and getting this massive echo off the coming from all around, which was, the ridiculous other end of the spectrum. It was quite difficult to contain it. Two very different experiences.
Wow. What do you remember? What you did with the Wolfgang Press?
Yeah, I just, funnily enough, all I did was played those bongos that my grandparents had given me several years earlier. So, I mean, mainly their percussion was all electronic, but they just wanted some. Yeah, they wanted some additional live percussion put onto a couple of their tracks, so I went in and did that.
I only remember one track. I don't know where it came from, but I had a copy of Kansas, and I don't know if it seemed like a big hit for Wolfgang Press. It was a great video with all, like, I think Nixon was in the video, you know, like everybody had like a mask on. It was a really well shot video. It was just...
They had a big hit single in the States with something, but it wasn't, I can't think of the name of the track now. It wasn't Kansas. And then bizarrely, they did a show with Tom Jones singing with them in LA, I think it was, in the mid 80s.
Wow. Wow.
And they wrote a song for him as well, which he recorded and put on one of his albums.
I grew up with Tom Jones. Saturday night, Tom Jones. Boom. Is that kind of? There was a microphone in the middle of the TV screen, black and white, of course. And then this hand grabbed it, you know. And I thought, oh, it's him. He's horrible. He's so dirty.
every single singer in a pub band after that, right, after Tom Jones, had the very tight pants and the beer gut sticking over
sides
over the top with the shirt undone and the medallion, you know.
Oh, what a lovely vision.
Yeah, a hairy chest and a medallion.
I know. Where we just come from? Cocteau Twins, 4AD, Wolfgang Press, and then here we are.
Oh, we did come via Working Men's Club, so.
Oh, we did. We threw that in.
Robin and Liz used to drink in my friend's restaurant just down the street.
Yeah, I read that story. Yeah, where you
met them. And it was very nice. It was very civilized, you know.
Oh, they're lovely. Yeah.
I can't remember at all what we talked about much that night because we ended up. My house was like 2 minutes walk, so we just ended up back at my house and playing records and talking gibberish as one does until the early mornings, you know.
I didn't get to meet Liz. I met Liz very recently. After she'd got back and played live with Massive Attack, working with John Grant, and I think John's manager Fiona and Liz are very close, and so she would turn up backstage, and I was thinking, that looks like Liz Fraser. But after all the years, you know, you finally get to say hello to some people, and you, it's like when I met Viv Albertine, having spent many days in a rehearsal room and yet not a long time together and never had long conversations. One of my things I come back to is when we met, it was like picking up on a very intense conversation that we never had all these years later. Do you find... No, because you've just been speaking with Brendan and Lisa about, you know, how you feel about the book. Is it okay what I've been writing? You know, was that part of it? Did you have those conversations when you were working together and busily getting everything shipshape? Did you have that kind of conversation, or is that something new?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things that came out of that was how differently we remembered certain things that happened back in the day. Really quite, you know, I thought I had these really vivid memories of how a particular incident happened, and then they would, one of them would say, oh no, it didn't happen like that, it was, you know, and give me a different account with still the same basic elements to it, but then other parts of it were totally different. And I genuinely have no idea, because my memory seems so strong of how I remembered it. So there was one example that I actually put in the book of where we'd been for a dinner one night in Venice, and I told it the way I remembered it came about, and then Lisa sent me an email saying, I remember that night, but I remember it this way, and gave me a different. So I put both accounts in the book, and quite a few people have commented that they found that really interesting, really liked that.
That sounds wonderful.
The two tellings of the same story.
I could hear three or four versions of, you know, dinner with Lisa and Brendan in Venice. Oh, come on, tell me another version. I had that where I met the bass player in my first band, the Spitfire Boys, and he started telling me this story, and I'm thinking, hang on, that's my story, and you were not even in it. it had Bruce Forsyth in it. It had The Clash in it. A good hotel reception sort of like get-together of bands, you know, in Brighton. So the cast of characters was the same, except... He told the story. I thought, I wasn't even in your band at that point. We were all together. It was our first gig, like first tour. And we couldn't have been more different. But I straight away had to defer to his version, because how could he have known?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. No, I haven't had the experience of somebody stealing one of my stories before.
Well, I have another version of that kind of story, which might be stolen from somebody else, but a good friend of mine was ghostwriting a famous singer's book for him. And but, you know, he would call him round and tell him all these stories. And he told him this story, he told my friend this story. And my friend thought, wow, that's a great story. We should put that in the book. And but I better do due diligence and go and talk to the other six people that are in this story, right? And he did. He went around and talked to them all, and they all said the same thing. He wasn't there. He's just heard us tell this story so many times, he's just written himself into it.
That's brilliant.
I think I'm going to do that just for the hell of it now.
Yeah.
And write myself into all the stories I've heard recently.
I've done it all my life.
But you've now got a book in the pipeline, have you?
Yes, I have. I've had it. I know I've been writing it for decades.
And this is memoir?
And it's memoir because it's what I've always had there. But what it's been doing for me resuscitated my love of reading. You know, I've always thought I never have the time to read a book, like I don't have the time to listen to music. And both of those things have come back into my life in a strange ways. You know, the idea of putting my all the bits of writing I've done. It used to take me like 10 years to get a lyric together because, you know, there would be, the filtration system was so strong within the band. You're the drummer. The drummers don't write lyrics. And so, you know, I pieced together something that was like bits from like 10 years ago and finally find something relevant. And music, I took up a teaching job in Berlin at the British College, and that put me right back with young people and how it feels to be young and in music. It's priceless. I couldn't carry on doing it because it was just eating up too much time, too much headspace.
When was that? How long ago was that?
It's been for the last 8 years. It's been up until just, recently.
Just up until recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because now it just feels like with, two small children and the podcast and an album and a tour, there's so much going on, you know.
So are you two touring together?
Are we touring together, Lon?
Yeah, we should be. We're on the same bus. I know that much.
Okay.
So,
Yeah. Who's going to clean up? Who's cleaning up in the morning?
I don't know.
Who's handing out the PD?
Yeah, well, that's the point, yes.
I think it's Mickey's boys. Mickey's boys are doing that. We're sharing a bus with we've roped everybody together because we wanted to do a bus tour. We got Mickey Berendi.
Oh, have you?
With the band Lush. Yeah, but we haven't got her. She's got us. Opening for her, so
right.
Let's get their priorities right here.
Are you coming to the UK?
The bus won't get that far.
Is this in the States? Is this in the States? Then?
Yeah.
Okay. It's going to be a West Coast over to East Coast thing,
right?
You know, with stopping in Chicago, the old kind of like major city drop in. And it'll either make or break us, Lol.
Yeah,
I think
it'll make us.
But what about you, Lol? Are you writing again? Have you got more in the pipeline?
Yeah, number three coming out. So, excellent. It's not coming out yet, but I can't stop.
It's coming out of you, isn't it? It's coming out.
It's coming out of me, yeah.
Well, should we round it up?
It would be very nice to go for a pint now, but distance prevents.
Yeah. It does.
Just say thanks very much, Peter. It's been a pleasure and just...
Well, oh, thank you for having me on. It's been great.
What a lovely journey.
We should have a TV show soon, I think, and then you'll be on that one as well.
I'll be there.
Curious Creatures is presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio design, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate Producer, Sophie Wild.
Associate Producer and Digital Marketing, Marge Taylor.
Visual Designer, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music Production, Jack Knifley.
Assistant Editor, Ben Miller.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2024.